Thank you for being in our evening study. Tonight we will be looking at John chapter 21, the last chapter in the Gospel of John, looking at the first 14 verses. You might recall that Mary Magdalene and the other Mary visited the tomb of Jesus on the first day of the week following his crucifixion, and his body had been laid in the tomb. And an angel met them there and told them, "Go quickly and tell his disciples that he had risen from the dead. And behold, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Behold, I have told you." That's Matthew's account. It's also recorded in Mark 16 and verse 7. You might recall that Galilee is the region or the province where the Lord lived, as he made ready for his public ministry. John's next words, beginning in chapter 21 and verse 1, are words about what happened in Galilee. "After these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and he manifested himself in this way." It's interesting to me that the word manifested is used there. This present circumstance that John's writing about is more than just a casual acquaintance with meeting with some old friends. It's really a manifestation of himself. It's a further strengthening of exactly who the Lord is. It is a sharing with them once again what is necessary to strengthen their faith, to bolster their knowledge that he is indeed the Messiah, that they're seeing him is not a result of visions that they're having. It's not fantasies. It's not their wild imagination running away with them. It's not dreams. It's not some result of mass hysteria. And this is significant because the disciples' confidence in the coming days must be built on the absolute knowledge that Jesus rose from the dead. They're going to go into all the world and preach this message to people. Their lives are going to be on the line. They're going to suffer persecution. They're going to be threatened with death for preaching such a message as this. And they must be assured. They must be 100% rock solid that they are saying the truth when they say that Jesus rose from the dead. Otherwise, they would be without the necessary boldness and courage that they must have to confront the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem with their sin of rejecting him as the Messiah and having him crucified, and proclaim to the men and women of all nations this unsettling testimony that he was indeed risen, that he was the glorified Son of God, and he must be obeyed, and the people must follow his authority, Jew and Gentile alike. So only with that certain knowledge and that conviction could they effectively and powerfully present the gospel message to other people. That type of knowledge and conviction could only be strengthened in them after having been established in them through numerous appearances of the Lord over a period of many days and under a variety of circumstances. And this was the Lord's plan and purpose in several of the manifestations that are portrayed in the Gospels. Combining all the accounts of the appearances of the Lord, this is the seventh time that he appeared to someone after his resurrection. Recall that Jesus had instructed his disciples to return to Galilee where he was to meet them. Interestingly, Matthew records only those appearances of the Lord in Galilee. On the other hand, Mark and Luke notice only those appearances in Jerusalem. John, on the other hand, gives some of both. And after these appearances in Galilee, the disciples returned again to Jerusalem, where they remained from the ascension until the day of Pentecost. The description of the lake in Galilee as the Sea of Tiberias is something that you will find only in John's gospel. It's only John that depicts the body of water that way. The other writers call it the Sea of Galilee or the sea. And I think Luke one time calls it the Sea of Gennesaret. It was called the Sea of Tiberias because a very large city, center of commerce, most conspicuous, maybe the most important metropolis on the shore of this sea, was located on the southwestern coast, and it took its name from a Roman emperor. In verse 2, Simon Peter and Thomas, called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. You notice that that number doesn't add up to 11. Four of the five men named in this group were together at the beginning of Christ's ministry, namely Simon Peter, Nathanael, the sons of Zebedee, which would be James and John, according to Matthew 4 and verse 21. So we're not at all surprised to see those old friends together once more. Two other of his disciples are not named. Probably because John is not going to relate anything, any additional information that might be significant about them, so we don't know who they were. It's interesting to note that here it is for the very first time in this little seemingly insignificant thing that we learn that Nathanael was from Cana in Galilee. Simon Peter said to them in verse 3, "I'm going fishing." They said to him, "We will also come with you." They went out and got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. As is the case elsewhere in the gospel narratives, Peter is the one who is depicted as the man of action. "I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that." He's always the one that seems to be the natural leader, and that might be very well the reason why the Lord chose him and said, "Peter, I'm going to give you the keys of the kingdom." He just seemed like a natural leader, even though the impression that we get about John himself is John is the one where the light bulb comes on in understanding before Peter understands. But Peter is quick to act and John is more reserved. But one of the questions that many times comes up in this very passage right here is, why are they fishing? It's a pretty good question. It's pretty interesting to think about. You might recall that before they had left their nets and left their fishing boats, the sons of Zebedee left their father with the fishing business, and they went off to study and learn from Jesus from a period of about 3 years. And so what does it mean now that they're saying, "We're going fishing"? This story may suggest that the disciples have returned to their trade after their hopes and aspirations and views of the kingdom and being a part of it had been shattered. I don't know that that's really the case. The record doesn't tell us. It's possible. Maybe Peter has given up on his ambition to preach the gospel of the kingdom since he shamelessly denied the Lord, and maybe he was struggling to get over that, and so he went back to fishing. Maybe the rest had gone back to their livelihood after the death of Jesus and the dispersing of the disciples because of the situation in Jerusalem. But here, think about this. The Lord had warned them that the time would come when they would be scattered, each to his own home, in John 16 and verse 32. So maybe that's the ideal fit for why it is that they are in Galilee. The Lord had sent a message to them to go there, and they were fishing at this time. Maybe they all felt unworthy of the confidence that Jesus had placed in them. I'm sure that probably entered their mind. Maybe they wanted to enjoy the peace and the solitude of the lake once more. Maybe they needed the income that fishing would generate. That's certainly a possibility. Peter had members of his household, his family, that he was responsible for. So maybe they were just employing themselves usefully while they were waiting for the fulfillment of the promise of the Lord. So we can't really be certain about the circumstances that were in place. We know only that they went fishing, and all of them appeared to be very enthusiastic to do so, and that's what they did. Some of the men whose names are given in verse 2 were experienced fishermen. But at times, as you know, if you have fished any, that you can't always select the right time where you're going to have a great catch. And evidently, this was such a time. Night was evidently a favorite time for fishing in the Sea of Galilee, as referenced also in Luke chapter 5. Luke chapter 5 and verse 5 shows, "Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing." And maybe there is a reason why these two events are spoken of in the same way. We fished all night and we caught nothing. Maybe it was a remembrance thing. Maybe that would cause us to remember what happened many, many months before. Night fishing may have ensured that the catch would be fresh for a sale the next morning. They could sell their fish to people that were getting ready to prepare food for the day. It may have been preferable because it was cooler on the lake at night rather than out there in the blazing sun during the daytime. Or it could have been considered the best time simply because experience showed them that's when they would bring in more fish. Whatever the case, history is about to repeat itself for the episode that's recorded in Luke 5. It's duplicated in a number of ways. They fished all night. They caught nothing, John explains. Their efforts ended in disappointment, just as they had on another night some 3 years before. In verse 4 beginning, "But when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, 'Children, you do not have any fish, do you?' They answered him, 'No.' And he said to them, 'Cast the net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you will find a catch.' So they cast, and then they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish." Put yourself in that situation. Dawn is breaking. You're about the length of a football field from the shore. And as dawn is breaking, and maybe it's hazy, you would expect a lot of moisture to be in the air around that body of water. Maybe they can't see too clearly enough to make out the identity of the person on the shore that's speaking to them. That you could certainly understand how that could be the case. It's similar to all the cases of Christ's post-resurrection appearances, because in all of them, he is not immediately recognized. The Lord's greeting of the disciples as children may have been a subtle hint to them about who he is. Or it may have been just a situation where he was saying, "Boys, have you caught any fish? Boys, do you have any fish?" There's a question that any potential customer would ask someone wanting to purchase some of their catch. So at this point, they don't know for sure. They don't know if it's the Lord yet. They may have supposed that this stranger knew something that they did not. Maybe he saw from where he was a school of fish headed in the direction where if they cast their nets on the right-hand side of the boat, they would catch something. Maybe that was the situation. But in any case, they were desperate by this time, after having fished all night and caught nothing. Okay, we'll try what this guy says, throwing the net on the right-hand side of the boat. When they did so, their net was filled with fish, so much so that they could not draw it back to the boat. The occasion evidently reminded them immediately of another episode on the Sea of Galilee, which was strikingly similar in many respects. The fact that they instantly recognize that the strange figure standing on the beach is Jesus is really not all that surprising. Maybe that was the Lord's calculated intention. It was not good fortune that produced this great net full of fish, either here or in Luke 5. It is definitely recorded as a miraculous event. In verse 7, therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved, which you and I come to appreciate that expression, John willing to exclude himself from his own writing in order to focus on events that happen with other people and what they believe and what happens to them over and above himself, said to Peter, it is the Lord. So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from land, but about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. So the light bulb comes on very quickly with John, doesn't it? For it remembers a former miracle of this same kind, and said to his fishing partner and his constant companion, Peter and John were always hanging out together, it's the Lord. Peter, being impulsive, threw himself into the sea in order to be the first person ashore. Some translations use the word naked here in this verse. That does not necessitate total nudity. A man who had simply the tunic upon him was practically thus regarded as naked, according to H.R. Reynolds. And I think that is right. You and I wouldn't refer to a man out mowing his lawn wearing his undershirt or his t-shirt as a naked man. But people would have referred to such a man in that way at this time. So while he was at work, he was naked. That is, he had stripped all but his light undergarment to facilitate easy movement as he and the others worked with fishing nets. So Peter put on his upper garment as he prepared himself to go ashore and meet the Lord. He could very well, according to the culture of the day, thought it quite unseemly to be presented to anyone only half clad. Since the rest of his disciples were less impulsive than Peter, and since someone had to care for the fish and someone had to care for the boat, the others came on the shore but arrived after Peter. John gives this distance to be about 100 yards, about the length of the football field, and the other disciples covered this space in the little boat, dragging the net full of fish behind them. So when they got, in verse 9, out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish which you have now caught. Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. The question usually comes up, who prepared the charcoal fire? And who prepared the fish and the bread? The very strong implication, although it does not specifically state, but the very strong implication is that Jesus prepared this simple meal that was ready for them when they came ashore. Was it prepared supernaturally? Was it a miracle? John doesn't tell us, but most probably so it was. There's a lesson here. God provides for his people in any way he wishes and in any manner he wishes. Also, there seems to be a reminder here of John 6, beginning in verse 9, wherein Jesus miraculously provided loaves and fishes for hungry people. Maybe Christ is thus reminding them of that miracle on this day. even as he had just reminded them of the supernatural abundance of fish that they caught before that Luke writes about in Luke 5. Jesus then told them to bring some of the fish which they had caught. The miraculous provision of 153 fish had both a practical purpose and a spiritual lesson to teach. Why did John find it necessary to tell us 153 fish? You know, people have made a lot of over that through the years. And they've taken this number, 153, and they've analyzed it and overanalyzed it and continue to overanalyze it until they come up with some pretty wild theories about some significant thing with deep spiritual meaning that this number means. There's nothing to indicate to us anything like that. Maybe it's just something that John remembered about the occasion. How many fish did y'all catch? Well, the net was so full we had difficulty bringing it ashore. Well, how many? Somebody counted them, and that number stuck with somebody, 153. You know, if you were on a fishing expedition and you fished one night and didn't catch anything, and then you cast the net and it was so full you couldn't even pull it in the boat, and when you got ready to count those fish, don't you think that you might remember how many fish were in that net? I think I would. That many. Maybe that's all there is to it. In the miraculous feedings of the multitude with the loaves and fishes, the Lord had taken what the disciples had provided and multiplied it and used it to supply the needs of many. Here he showed that he would continue to multiply and bless their efforts. But he does not, he does require their efforts to be put forth, doesn't he? He didn't just rain fish out of the sky on them. They had to work for what they caught. And that formed the basis of all the further good that they were going to do. This is indeed a universal principle of gospel work in their day and in ours. God cooperated with the efforts of his people that were going through the world, teaching the gospel to people. The Lord could have chosen to do that in another way. He could have dropped leaflets in everybody's language from the sky, but he didn't. He chose to use natural means, and God would work with those natural means in order to increase and provide what they needed. Many people have tried to advance their theories about this symbolism. But I think it could probably be just a situation where John merely remembered the number because, number one, he was there and he saw it with his own eyes. And because, number two, the number was altogether impressive because of the size of these enormous fish and because they were so numerous. They did not even break the net. John is greatly impressed that the net is not broken by the weight of this large number of fish. As an experienced fisherman, he was certainly aware as to what would break a fishing net. But he records here that the net was not broken. It was not damaged in any way. Many times, these men sat around when they were not fishing, repairing their net, making them stronger. Not on this day. The same powerful hand that brought the fish into the nets was fully capable of holding them there and fully capable of seeing to it that their nets were not damaged. In verse 12, Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples ventured to question him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. This is now the third time Jesus was manifested to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. Why are we told of this invitation of the Lord to his disciples to eat breakfast with him? You ever wondered about that? Have you ever wondered, would there be any significance to that? What does it mean? Why is it important? Why does John tell us something? John is not writing just so he can put down a bunch of words about something he knew about while he was alive and then publish it in a book someday and make big royalties off of it. That's not what John is doing. But what John is doing is telling us details that are very important for the one purpose that he's already stated at the end of chapter 20. Why are we told of this invitation of the Lord to the disciples to eat with him? It's a further demonstration of the Lord's resurrection from the dead. His bodily resurrection. It wasn't a vision. It wasn't a dream. It wasn't a hallucination. There are many who said that the appearance of the risen Christ were nothing more than visions that the disciples had. Really? Then why would there be a situation where they sat down and ate a meal together? Only people in bodies do that, don't they? Some would go further and say these weren't visions, they were hallucinations. All of his disciples were on some kind of drug. Really? John's gospel insists that the risen Christ is not a vision, not a hallucination, not even a spirit, but a real person with flesh and blood needs. The risen Lord was not a ghost. He was not a figment of someone's imagination, someone's excited imagination. It was the Lord who had conquered death and come back from the dead. That's exactly who it was. They were convinced. The Lord wants us to be convinced based on their testimony. And this is one way to do it. Here is the setting where they are eating together, as they used to do so very many times. His return to them was not intended to renew the continuity of their life with him, and the fact that he ate with him was a symbol of his real presence in their midst. Peter must have been especially impressed by this, because Peter referred to this later in his preaching, in Acts 10, verse 40 and 41, here is Peter preaching, and he says, in the household of Cornelius, God raised him up on the third day and granted that he become visible, not to all the people, but to witnesses who were chosen beforehand by God. That is, to us who ate and drank with him after he arose from the dead. Now that's pretty rock solid eyewitness evidence of what you have seen and done, isn't it? Do you know who you ate and drank with today? If you told somebody that, how credible would it be? Now, if you all the time are telling people that you ate and drank with the President of the United States, someone might ask for an additional witness to that. But under normal circumstances, people would believe what you say. John does not say it was the third appearance of Jesus, but he says it's the third time that Jesus manifested himself to his disciples as a group or as the apostles, as it is here in this sense and used in other places as well. John records the first time he appeared to the 10 apostles on the evening of the day of his resurrection in John 20 and verse 19. The second was to the 11 apostles. You remember Thomas wasn't with them the first time, but he was the second time. 1 week later, John 20 and verse 26. And now this third time in an appearance to a group is here on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, which out of the total number of times that the Lord appeared to anyone, 12, this would be number 7. Very interesting section of the Scripture. In our study of John, have you come to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? That's exactly why John wrote this gospel. If you had already believed that when we began our study, has your faith been strengthened? Has it been strengthened to the point that you can help someone else develop that faith by studying the gospel of John with them? I hope so. I hope that's the case. You're subject to the Lord's invitation. Please respond to Him in obedience to His will in order that you might enjoy the forgiveness of your sins. If that's your desire tonight, we'd love to help you. If we can, please come and let me know about it while we stand together and encourage you by singing the invitation song.